interviewing your favorite musicians, comedians, and other creative souls. This is The Kerry Edelman Show.
Welcome to The Kerry Edelman Show. I am so excited today as we have the amazingly talented poet Bart Edelman coming on momentarily. I always like to do a brief introduction to the show, and then I'm going to do a little bio on him, and then we'll bring him on for the interview. He's going to be joining today some of the amazing 250-plus artists, comedians, authors, and entertainers that I've had the pleasure of interviewing over the years. I do an in-depth interview, so it is going to be a long-form interview, but I really like to do this because it really gets you involved in learning the history about the guests on my show. It's not going to be an interview where we're just asking cookie-cutter questions. It's really going to be involved in a lot of dialogue. Some of the guests I've had on include comedian and head writer for Seinfeld, Peter Melman, co-creator of The Daily Show, and former David Letterman TV producer, Madeline Smithberg, New York Times bestselling author Jennifer Kishen Armstrong, and the award-winning cartoonist and illustrator for The New Yorker, Bob Eckstein, to name a few. I also have to throw out there, I do have a background in psychology and a doctorate degree in clinical psychology. My show is going to be an entertainment show, but we're not doing any type of formal therapy or assessment. I always throw that out there. But we will talk about stuff in an educational format if it arises, because I know people are interested in psychology and mental health, especially how it gets incorporated into entertainment. So let's do an introduction for Bart, and then we'll bring him on. Bart currently lives in Pasadena, California. He earned both his undergraduate and graduate degrees from Hofstra University. As a professor, he has taught at over a half a dozen colleges, which have included UCLA, Santa Monica College, and Glendale, where he edited Eclipse, a literary journal. More recently, he was appointed to the affiliate faculty in the MFA program at Antioch University in Los Angeles. His work has been widely anthologized in textbooks that have been published by Longman, McGraw-Hill, and Simon & Schuster, to name a few. Bart has been awarded grants and fellowships from numerous universities to conduct literary research in India, Egypt, Nigeria, and Poland. Collections of his poetry are extensive, and include Crossing the Hackensack, Under Damaris's Dress, The Alphabet of Love, The Gentleman, The Last Mojito, The Geography's Wife, and Whistling to Trick the Wind. So today we are going to be delving into and discussing his new poetry book, This Body is Never at Rest, New and Selected Poems, 1993 to 2023, which was published by Meadowlark Press. For more information, you can visit Bart at bartedelman.com and follow him on Facebook. Welcome, Bart.
Good afternoon, Kerry. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I am just splendid.
Good. I hope the introduction did you justice.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. All right. So let's start out. I often like to start, we'll bounce around, but I like to start from the beginning. So let's talk a little bit about yourself. You know, you were born in Paterson, New Jersey. You grew up in Teaneck, New Jersey. So as far back as you can remember, you know, as a little kid, you know, how would you describe yourself? How would you describe your personality? Were you someone who was shy or someone who was more social and outgoing? Tell us a little bit about that. And then we're going to, of course, delve into your writing and everything.
Kerry, I think a little bit of both. There was a shy quality, I think, to me. But if you got me interested in sports, or writing, anything like that, I was quickly drawn to it. I loved playing Little League baseball. I loved reading biographies of sports figures. I think that was my interest in reading, was mostly sports to begin with. And then little by little, things turned around. But yes, a lot of stuff having to do with sports kind of pulled me out, I think, from being, as you would say, a shy person.
Okay. And tell us, like, what can you remember as a little kid? What were some of the biographies, you know, share with us some of them that you read?
So they were either sports figures for the most part or political figures. So I would read a lot about presidents and vice presidents, And then sports figures, anything from Jackie Robinson, baseball, hockey, basketball, track stars.
Cool.
I was a reader, so anything I could get my hands on, I would read. Very often at night, under the covers with a flashlight, stuff that I should have been reading during the day, but I would read at night and hope that my mother didn't walk in and catch me at 10 o'clock when I was supposed to be in bed by 9 o'clock.
Nice. Gotcha. And, you know, of course, bringing in your mother and your father, you know, did they read to you as a little kid? And if they did, can you remember anything about the first book they read to you?
I think one of the first books that was read to me certainly was Winnie the Pooh.
Okay.
House at Pooh Corner. I was read to, and that helped. Gave me a tremendous interest in reading. And both my parents read every night before they went to sleep. They also read, my father would read when he came home from work. He would sit either outside if it was in the summer, and he would read, or inside he would sit on the bark lounger chair and he would read. But they would always read before bed. My father would read more mysteries and biographies, and my mother would read biographies and usually novels or short story collections.
Okay, interesting. And I'm assuming, I mean, would you say they had a really good vocabulary in terms of, like you do, you know, when you're writing, I mean, your vocabulary is just extensive.
I think that my mother and her sisters, she had three sisters. These women had just this love of words and language and expressions. To this day, I still use some of them. I'm still trying to figure out what these funny expressions meant, where they got them. I ask my cousins often. I say to my cousin Amy all the time, where did that come from? And sometimes we can find out, but sometimes maybe there's some great mystery of almost not knowing how these expressions came into being. But there are these cute sayings. Everybody usually had pet names. And so, you know, here we go into this just interest in language and words, and not just words, but the multiplicity of meanings for words.
Mm-hmm.
And especially, obviously, poets use that. You know, you have a word and, you know, the first draft of what you're writing, especially verbs. And, you know, how did this woman cross the street? Well, she could walk across the street, of course, but it's much more fascinating when you start to examine verbs. And, you know, if someone was attracted to the woman, maybe she swayed across the street, maybe she dashed across the street. But it's just, again, that interest in language and words and, you know, what that does to language itself.
No, it's very interesting, definitely. What's one of the favorite things that your mother and her sisters, you know, one of the interesting things they said that you still use to this day? Is there one in particular you want to share?
Well, it's funny because last night my wife and I were watching the Jackie Robinson story, a biography that I had read before. But I always remember my mother using the expression even before I knew who Jackie Robinson was. Just everything was as fast as Jack Robinson.
Okay.
And if you didn't know who Robinson was, you you know, you just think, oh, must be some figure. Then you find out, of course, you know, Jackie Robinson was the fastest ball player, you know, of his era.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's just a lot of expressions. I think some of them also were Yiddish expressions,
mm-hmm.
obviously the Jewish background. They were probably German expressions because Yiddish is a combination of high and low German. So they were just things that even now I find myself saying and just marveling at the fact that my mother and her sisters definitely had fun with language. And I think that's carried out to just I have nine, all of them just really enjoy and pivot with language.
Neat. That's really cool. Really cool. Getting back to what we were talking about with the writing and stuff, was TV something too? I always like to pull in a little pop culture just while we're talking. You know, what TV shows did you enjoy watching growing up? Was there any that your parents or your siblings watched that also you gravitated towards?
Well, I remember very early on liking certain cartoons and shows that were for kids. I think I got to watch TV after dinner up until I think it was 7 or 7:30 before
okay.
I needed to go to bed. And there was a show on that I used to love called Terry Toon Circus. And there was a guy who was dressed up as a circus performer, kind of a ringleader, Claude Kirshner. And all I remember is Claude Kirshner always at the end of the show would look into the camera and say, "It's time for most of you kids to go to bed." And it was 7:30. And I remember my father would look at me, and I knew that was time for me to go to bed. I liked a lot of cartoons, but I liked the cartoons. Remember the first cartoon I loved where they were able to move their lips and you could actually think they were talking.
Right.
And there was a cartoon, I think it was called Clutch Cargo. And I just remember being enamored with the fact that the lips moving, you know, mimicked exactly what he was saying rather than when they used to have, you know, just somebody's mouth open and words
right.
said. There was stuff on Saturday mornings that I would watch with my brothers, the Andy Devine show, a couple of others that I can't think of that I probably will in a minute or two.
Okay.
Crusader Rabbit. Yeah. This is stuff that I actually will go back on YouTube and and watch.
That's cool. That's cool. And just, you know, briefly, of course, with what you want to share, you know, bring in a little bit about your brothers in terms of, you know, just, you know, what they do for a living, or clearly there's probably a bunch of entertainment and artistic aspects in your family. So yeah, just share a little bit.
Well, my brother, my old brother, Arthur, is a teacher, a retired
mm-hmm.
teacher who taught in Jersey City. My brother, Randy, is a film composer. And I wrote lyrics with Randy before I was expressly writing poetry. I wrote
oh, wow.
some lyrics, yes, with him that were recorded. So those are my two brothers. One is in California and one is
mm-hmm.
in New Jersey.
Nice, nice. So again, as we see, there's definitely in the blood, so to speak, you know, this ability of teaching and writing and expressing oneself. So that's really, really cool. When you think back to...
I think it was something in the water.
Possibly.
Possibly, yeah.
And there's other, I mean, if you want to just glossing over, not getting into details. I mean, there's other family members from what I've read about that are also, you know, involved in entertainment.
Yeah, I don't know where to begin with this because they are, you're correct. There's so
right.
many. Adam Rogers is a
couple. Yes,
yeah, Adam Rogers is a pretty famous jazz guitarist who plays with Steely Dan and has played with Norah Jones and has played with so many different folks. His dad, Doug Rogers, was a song and dance man, was a TV director of some of the Rhoda shows.
Oh, wow.
Cousin Jewel Zalin is an entertainment lawyer. Zach Zalin is involved with entertainment. Adam Rogers' mother was a dancer and a singer, Ellie Zalin. There's a lot, Carrie, and I'm afraid if I go on, I'm going to leave somebody out.
No,
and,
that's okay. That's okay.
Somebody's going to come after me with a net.
No. Now, everyone, you know, we'll put it out there that everyone deserves the honor, and we know there's
yes.
tons of people out there. So, yes.
But you're right. It is a family definitely of performers in a way. And I think even in terms of conversations, we're often bringing out especially a sense of humor in everything.
Mm-hmm.
And so a combination of the performance aspect, we are a family of storytellers. That is certain.
Definitely. Definitely. So let's get into a little bit talking more about, you know, the poetry, your writing, like you said, your love of language. How old were you when you wrote your first poem? Can you remember the topic of what it was?
You know, good question. I can't remember exactly how old I was. I know that in high school I was writing, and in fact, the first poem that I have, I just sent a whole bunch of early work and rough drafts, diary entries to Hofstra University in New York because they're archiving all of my work in the Axum Library Special Collection. So your question just now rings a bell because it was in high school that I remember writing a poem that was in the Teaneck High School literary journal, which was called The Leaf. It
okay.
was also the only creative writing course I took, which is very interesting, having taught creative writing in college and then graduate school.
Mm-hmm.
I think often most folks have taken a slew, a battery, if you will, of creative writing courses. I didn't take any. The only creative writing course I ever took was from William Moore, who was a distinguished, bearded, wonderful teacher at Teaneck High School. I never took a creative writing course after that. So
really?
Not
even when you went to Hofstra?
No.
And we'll get into that in a little bit.
Sure.
Okay. Wow.
No, and this brings up an interesting kind of dichotomy of, again, for writers, you know, how much of a formal writing background do you need?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I find myself in an interesting position because for, you know, 5-6 years I taught in an MFA program at Antioch, and I can see both sides of the spectrum, meaning it's fine to take creative writing courses and to have a little network, a coterie of folks that you share your work with. I mean, that's all good. But some of the most famous writers never took a creative writing course.
Right, Right.
You know, whether it's Mark Twain, it's just totally open. And so all I can say is, you know, my undergraduate degree is in political science. I had a minor in philosophy. Then I went to Hofstra. Then I went to Hofstra and then I did a master's in English Lit. But that was studying more writers, not doing any creative writing on my own.
Okay. So let's digress back a little bit to, because I was going to bring up William Moore, because I saw that in, at the end of the book in terms of some of the thank yous and stuff. So tell us a little bit about, and then, of course, we're going to delve into college eventually. You know, how did this person impact you since that was your only creative writing course?
Yeah, I think the way that he impacted me was actually just as much outside of the classroom, because I remember speaking with him at the high school outside again of the classroom. But the other thing I found fascinating was he was the first teacher who actually invited students. It may have been only once or twice, but I remember going to William Moore's house a couple of blocks away from Teaneck High School. Yeah, and thinking that was really cool. Now, in college, everything was different. I mean, I had dinner with my professors. I ended up with some playing tennis, all kinds of things. But in high school, when you were 14 or 15, that was pretty cool to, you know, even if it was twice a year, you know, to be able to go and sit in the living room of your high school teacher. I'm not even sure we talked literature or writing. It could have been a lot of other things. But he was distinguished. And I remember thinking that, he was a pretty neat guy.
That's cool. So getting back to high school, as you said, I mean, when you're getting ready to eventually get into college and you decide to major in, let me just see if there was anything else I wanted to, actually, let's go back a little bit. With high school, what would you say you excelled in? Like, what were some of the subjects you really like and you gravitated towards? What were some that were more difficult for you?
I would say I excelled in very little. No, seriously.
Can you elaborate?
It was okay. Once again, I think I was more interested a little bit in reading and in sports and things like that. So I'm just saying in high school, yeah, I mean, I was lucky if I was like a C+ or B- student.
I had very little interest
in the courses I was taking. Probably that one creative writing course lit my fire a little bit. I was terrible in math, not math, algebra, geometry. So, you know, high school was okay. I enjoyed college, you know, so much more.
Okay. So, and when you were in high school, before you like went off to college, did you ever have any interesting jobs that you did to make money?
Yes. Some that were very short-lived. The one that I remember was working at a food town grocery store and being asked to clean the bathroom with tremendous amounts of ammonia, so much so that I could not get back in the bathroom after doing the supposed cleaning job, and I lasted one day there.
Okay.
Other than that, I was a camp counselor during the summers. And you know what is interesting? I do remember in, I think it was 11th grade, there was a kind of community newspaper. And I do remember writing a column for that. I think it also might have been a summer, but that was the first job. And I probably was paid, you know, like a quarter or something to do it.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. So that was the first time I did any writing that I think was kind of published in a, you know, in a newspaper or something of that nature.
Sure, sure. So as colleges, I mean, as high school is winding down and you're getting ready to apply to colleges, you know, what were some of the colleges you applied to, and then share with us what made you choose Hofstra?
Well, Hofstra came a little late in the game after my first year at Butler University in Indianapolis. So I went to Butler. I wanted to get kind of away from the East Coast. Butler is in Indianapolis. I had a little love affair with the city of Cincinnati, which I still do. And Indianapolis was 90 miles west of Cincinnati, and I had cousins in Indianapolis. So I went to Butler for 1 year, and that was a very, very difficult year because I didn't realize how much I loved New Jersey, how much I loved Manhattan and Greenwich Village. And that was very instrumental in me transferring to Hofstra because I knew, at least with Hofstra, it was only an hour away from where I grew up, 40 minutes away from Manhattan. So I knew that would be a very safe school to transfer to, because my father had actually said to me, you get to transfer once. That's it. Choose wisely.
Right.
And I did get into the School of Government at American University in Washington, D.C., but part of me was scared that I would choose incorrectly and then be stuck in Washington. And so for many reasons, I thought Hofstra would be a good bet.
Nice, nice. So when you're going to Hofstra, that's interesting that you were majoring in actually philosophy.
Political science. With a minor in philosophy.
Minor in philosophy. What was your goals? Like, what were you planning, you know, before, again, eventually you pivot and you go in a different direction? What did you want to do with that potentially?
You know, I think my interest in political science actually had to do with elections and voting. And while that is part of political science, what you study for the most part with political science is, you know, governments and systems and all of that. And I found out that I was not very interested in that at all. So the interesting thing is, outside of political science, I didn't take my first English, forget about creative writing. I did take freshman composition at Butler when I was in Indianapolis, but I didn't take any more English courses until my senior year at Hofstra, where I took a comparative lit course. I took one English kind of American romanticism. I took that, and then last semester senior, kind of a light bulb went off, probably because I wondered, what the hell am I going to do with myself at this point?
Right.
And I became terribly interested in literature. And I remember asking some folks, what would graduate school be like if I did a degree in American Lit or English Literature? And when I was told, oh, you take more courses in, you know, the Romantic poets or in, you know, European novelists, I thought that would be great. And so that's the way I kind of, you know, advanced into graduate, I mean, into, yeah, into graduate school. And because I had so few courses, in literature. I only had, or English, I only had like 9 units. And
right.
I believe they were 27 units, you know, before they would admit you.
Oh, wow.
I was provisionally accepted, and I was kind of, you know, it was a balancing act in the beginning. I almost had to learn to write totally differently, because when I handed in a political science paper, they didn't care. They cared more about the content
right.
than the technique and the structure. But
right.
now you go to graduate school for English Lit, and boy, everything is under a microscope. So I really had to relearn things.
Yeah, so how did you get provisionally accepted? Tell us a little bit about, like, what does that mean? How did you kind of, you know, not dodge the bullet, so to speak, where they made you go back and say, hey, you got to take, you know, more than 9 credits
exactly.
or units?
Yes, and I remember actually applying, or at least getting in touch with UCLA, because I had gone to UCLA just for a summer. I think it was 1972, between my sophomore and junior year at Hofstra, and took
okay.
12 units, and that was great. Came back to Hofstra. But then I was looking at UCLA for graduate school, and I remember them telling me, you need to take a whole year's worth of English classes.
Right.
And then we'll admit you, and I didn't want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
I also was very fortunate because I was vice president of my class at Hofstra. And so what
oh, nice.
That meant was that I had, again, this unique relationship with a lot of professors there, because I served on certain committees where I was kind of the student liaison. So those
gotcha.
Folks helped when I applied to graduate school at Hofstra. With my lack of English credits, those Leo Gurko, Frank Lombasa,
mm-hmm.
helped speak to William Hull and say, you know, you ought to give this guy a chance. Yes, he lacks this or that. So that led me to be right accepted into the program as what they called then a non-matriculated student, which only meant you were kind of provisionally accepted, and that first, you know, semester, you
okay.
had to maintain a certain average, and then boom, you went in. But not only did I want to go to graduate school with like 9 units of English, but Hofstra had 2 different programs. They had
oh.
one that was a night program that was more for teachers who were like high school, who wanted to kind of advance on the salary level. They must add 150 students, let's say, during the night. During the
okay.
day, they only had 12 students. So not only did I want to get in, but I wanted to be one of those 12 students. And that
and so,
somehow, mysteriously, miraculously
worked out.
Yeah.
That's
yep.
awesome. So when you got into the master's program, were you also working on the side?
Yes, I worked down below the student union building. It's very funny. There was a
okay.
place called the Rathkeller, which was kind of like a German bar. And I worked there actually carding people to make sure they were old enough to drink.
Oh, nice.
And in addition, I did have a very small scholarship that Hofstra gave me, which helped defer some of the tuition.
Awesome. Awesome. That's great. So you basically, right, when you were finished up with the BA, you went straight in pretty much to the master's program.
Yes, I did.
Okay. 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 All right. So you finish your master's, right? And then is your first, you know, after you finish the master's, tell us a little bit about getting jobs. You know, what was that like? Was it something that was easy? You know, where did you apply? Let's go a little bit into that and talk about the college career and your teaching career.
Yeah. So what happened with that? It's what very often is referred to as the, you know, catch 22 dilemma, which mm-hmm. means that I was sprung out of graduate school. I hadn't taught before, and any time I attempted to get in touch with any college or community college, you know, they wanted teaching experience, and of course I had none.
Right.
So I remember I was lucky again. There was a program. It was an internship program at Kingsborough Community College in New York. And they admitted, or they hired, they were supposed to hire 10 new teachers. And they were to hire these teachers really to combat this problem, which meant they were going to let you teach two classes so that you at least could get your feet wet. And at least you would have some experience so that when you applied elsewhere, at least on your vita, you know, you would at least be able to say you had taught classes.
Right.
And the thing that I remember was they were supposed to get a certain amount of money and hire 10 folks. And you come out of any program in the United States. And they only got the money for 5. So for 2 or 3 months, I didn't know what I was going to do. I remember this was the summer of 1974, and I had no idea. I went to work for a little book company in Westwood, New Jersey.
Okay.
And it was only the last week before Labor Day when when classes at colleges at that time were going to start up again, that I had got a call from someone who had interviewed me before for this internship program and really saved my life at this point.
Wow.
By saying they had received a little bit more grant money and they would hire 3 more people. And he asked if I would be interested and jokingly enough said, well, have you taken any other jobs yet?
Right.
Yeah.
Wow.
Of course, I remember saying, no, how soon can I start? So
awesome.
That really saved me, because it was a year later that I went out to California. I didn't have a job, but at least I had taught 2 classes each semester for Kingsborough, which was part of the city university. So
right.
when I did come out California in 1975, at least I could say I had this experience. And I think they seemed to like the fact that not only did I have the experience, but at the same time, it was from a different, you know, geographical area.
Neat. That's cool. Nice.
Yeah.
I think what's interesting, just to kind of weave this in, is just, you know, thinking of those moments you're talking about where, you know, you just had these people kind of, for whatever reason, come into your life, and they were just, you know, like the professors at the school, give this guy a chance for the master's program,
right.
you know, the teacher you had in high school that, you know, sparked some type of an interest in you. And then this new opportunity here where luckily you get this call, and it's just like, you know, it's like, it's just interesting to see how those things happen.
Absolutely. Very, very fortunate.
Yeah. Yeah. So what led to your decision after a year at Kingsborough, what led you to your decision to move to California?
I think when I had gone to UCLA, that's in 1972, mm-hmm. I really liked California, and part of me actually wanted to go to California back in 74. When I graduated from Hofstra, but I remember, once again, I did not have any college teaching experience or
mm-hmm.
anything, and I can actually remember my sister-in-law saying something to me. She was in California, like, I know how much you want to come out to California, But wouldn't it be wise to wait and see, which is exactly what I've been thinking too.
Mm-hmm.
So once again, at least when I, you know, when I came out in 1975, I had the experience so that I could go on interviews. And
right.
Once here, I taught that 1 year before I got my full-time job at Glendale, I taught at 4 different community colleges.
Wow. Well, no, I was going to highlight those. So, right, Santa Monica, the West Los Angeles, Long Beach City College, and then UCLA, right?
No, it was Glendale. Oh. UCLA came a little later.
Oh, sorry. Okay.
No problem.
And so how come you taught at 4 different colleges in 1 year? What was going on there?
I believe it's called money.
Okay. Right.
I needed to make a living. And remember,
right.
at 2 of the 4, all I had was one class. So,
okay.
And then the other intriguing thing was my girlfriend at that point, she was teaching at 3 other English programs at other community colleges. So the two of us were teaching at 7 different community colleges.
Oh, that's funny. That's funny.
And this brings up something that still goes on to this day, which is unfortunately the struggle and plight of the part-time community college or
mm-hmm.
undergraduate college teacher who has to string a bunch of different jobs together
right.
to even make a tiny bit of a living.
That's a shame.
Yeah, it's
but
terrible,
I know it, yeah.
But they can pay a part-timer half of what they pay a full-timer.
So go on.
No, that's really it. So for 1 year, I was teaching at those 4 different colleges, and then I was extremely lucky because Glendale had a full-time position, and in June of 1976, I got that position. So at the age of 24, I had a full-time tenured college teaching position, and I thought I was the most fortunate guy in the world.
That's amazing. I mean, and Glendale, talk a little bit about, you know, I mean, you were there for a very long time. I mean, that's where you ended your career, so to speak, before, of course, you know, you got involved with the MFA program at Antioch. But tell us a little bit about your experience there. The literary journal that you were involved in called Eclipse, and yeah, share with us some of that, and then we'll start delving into your poetry.
Sure. So Glendale, yes, I was there for 37 years. I taught a wide variety of classes from freshman comp, introduction to literature, everything, creative writing workshop, up and down remedial writing. And we were fortunate to be funded. So we had this national literary journal called The Eclipse. In the beginning, just students whose writing we would publish. But then
okay.
little by little, we got a series of grants, and we were able to take this journal, make it a national journal. But it was very, very unique because we were able to publish some of our students side by side with writers that had a national reputation. And some of the students worked on the journals, so they got a little literary education that way. And that journal was a national journal from 2000 until, I think, 2014. So almost 15 years. And I loved doing that. That was a lot of fun. And I worked with a woman named Susan Sisko, who did the layout, did all the pagination. And it, it, it was great. I still get letters and phone calls from some of the students that were in that journal, and that had a very, very positive effect on their lives.
That's great. That's great. No, I mean, I know that was a big part of, you know, the teachings over at Glendale, from what I read. So that's amazing. And then on the side, I mean, you were also, as you know, writing poetry. I mean, since 1993, where you started with Crossing the Hackensack. So let's start to tie in a little bit, you know, let me just kind of delve into highlight the books that you have out there right now, your poetry books, because it's an extensive collection. I want you to also, of course, share throughout the interview or, of course, at the end where people can purchase it. But, you know, 1993 is Crossing the Hackensack, and that was followed up by Under Damaris's Dress in 96. Then we had The Alphabet of Love, 99, The Gentleman in 2001, The Last Mojito in 2005, The Geographer's Wife in 2012, which I believe you took a sabbatical for. And finally, yes. Whistling to Trick the Wind, which was your last publication before the most recent one we're going to discuss in 2021. So, yeah, if you want, just, you know, highlight some of that. It's such a rich background you have with these poetry books. You know, highlight some of your experiences with writing these books, and then we'll start to delve into the latest one.
So Crossing the Hackensack was, yes, 1993 with Prometheus Press. And some of that is kind of an homage to growing up in New Jersey. There's a map of the Hackensack River, which is kind of ghosted into the on the back and of the front cover and the back cover as well. There's a picture of someone in a canoe on the water. So a lot of that has to do, there's kind of an education theme that runs through that book. But the education is not anything academic in nature. It's more the education, you know, all of us get growing up. And so there's a symbolic thing of aspect arc, I should say, to a lot of the narrators who are discovering something about themselves and especially where they are geographically in their lives, both physically and spiritually. That was the first book. The second book, Under Damaris's Dress, that book was 1996. That was done by Lightning Publications. There was usually about a 3 or 4 year interval between books. Sometimes it was two. The largest interval, which again I can't explain, was between 2012 and 2021,
right?
Between The Geographer's Wife and Whistling to Trick the Wind. Tell you exactly what happened there. There was a lot going on. I'm not sure why there were that many years, but sometimes that happens. And then it's interesting that it flipped back to just really two and a half years between Whistling to Trick the Wind, and then This Body is Never, you know, Never at Rest.
Sure.
Also, there's one other thing that we haven't spoken about, but most of that came before, which was a series of all of these grants that I received to study in India and Nigeria and Egypt. I'm only bringing that up because I think there's a lot of this geographical arc kind of in the work. Obviously, it's there in The Geographer's Wife, which is divided, you know, into sections, east, west, north, and south. But there is a lot of this movement, how we know where we're going. where we've been, that I think runs through a lot of the work.
Definitely. No, I mean, I had that, as you know, I did do that in the introduction, and I thought that was just fascinating that you had been given those opportunities and those grants. Just give a bullet or two on, you know, the specifics of conducting this literary research, you know, in India, Egypt, Nigeria, and Poland. What was, you know, just, again, that could probably be a whole, unfortunately, interview by itself, but
right.
What were you specifically doing and with this research? Like, was it qualitative,
right.
I'm assuming?
So here's what happened. The grants were administered by USC.
Mm-hmm.
They ran through, it was all through the department, U.S. Department of Education.
Right.
And the real the crux of everything was to come back and teach in my classes the subject matter that I was doing research on. So when I came back from India, and these were all to be, you know, taught in introduction to literature classes, very
okay.
often, you know, like English 102. But when I went to India, it was studying Indian writers who were writing in English, because there is no real unifying language in India. There are 23
okay.
major languages. There's 500 different dialects. The
wow.
major languages are English and Hindi.
Okay.
So these writers were writing in English. And so I would come back and I would teach Indian short stories in this introduction to literature class.
Cool.
In Egypt, it was a study of Naguib Mahfouz, who is an Egyptian novelist who wrote Midak Ali and a lot of wonderful novels. And he was, in fact, the first Arab writer to receive the Nobel Prize for Literature. I think it was 1988. So that was about
okay.
5 or 6 years after I came back. So I taught some of his work. And then when I went to Nigeria, I did a study of Bode Shawande, who was a Nigerian playwright, got a hold of some of his plays and taught them. In Poland, it was a Polish also playwright and artist, Witkacy. And so it was all to come back. Always had to write a 30, 40-page paper for the government. But
okay.
the thrust of it was teaching our students and having them open up to these, you know, very, very different worlds of literature and culture.
Right.
And it was fascinating. It was wonderful to do.
Yeah, it must have been an unbelievable experience just to go there, like you said, and just the diversity and the cultures and, yeah, wow, to learn about that.
Well, what was great was also in Nigeria and where we went, parts of India, what was really interesting was being the one white face in the crowd.
Right.
And just the reactions. Which I have to say, both in Nigeria and India, it was these wonderful, welcoming reactions from people, as opposed, unfortunately, to some reactions here when we meet different people, and
sure.
some people are just scared. And I've never felt so comfortable than I did eating lunch for, you know, 2 or 3 months. In the, you know, at the University of Ibadan in Nigeria. I mean, I was
That's
there.
Wonderful.
And then there were 500 Nigerians, and it was just a wonderful, wonderful opportunity.
No, that's wonderful. That's really cool. What a great experience, like you said, and just opportunity, and yeah, nice. Thank you for sharing that. No, I was very interested in that, so I'm glad that you tied that into like you said, the theme of these transitioning topics and movement in the books and the stories and the poems.
Right.
Just to point out real quick too, and then we'll delve into your new book. You know, I wanted to point out just the extensiveness of how widely anthologized your work has been in textbooks. I mean, I don't want to list every one, but, you know, Simon and Schuster and Lauman, McGraw-Hill, and Prentice Hall, Wadsworth, the list goes on. Just for people who are maybe not familiar with that term, how would you, you know, explain something being anthologized and what that means?
Yeah, it means just that a couple of things. One, sometimes you can have a champion of your work, somebody who does believe in your work and at least gets it out to the editors of a textbook.
Mm-hmm.
And they're aware of your work, and then they employ your work in some chapter. It could be on symbolism, it could be on tone, it could be on theme, it could be on any, you know, aspect of, in my case. So you can have someone, an editor. Other times it's the editor himself or herself who is aware of your work and has read, you know, your book, your books, whatever, and finds a poem that he or she likes.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, that gets a lot of play, because then your work is used in a textbook that is used at sometimes, you know, many, 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 many colleges.
Sure.
So when a poem does appear there, sometimes, yes, you do get a communication from students. Used to be letters. Now, of course, it's email.
Right.
But a very humorous aspect of this is students who are doing research on your work, and very often in their literature class, you know, they've got to write a short paper either on a poem that's in a textbook or a series of poems if they're doing a little study of you. But the funniest thing is when they've let this assignment get down to the final hour, and you get an email from a student, and I've written about this quite a few times, who is at their wit's end, and, you know, it's like midnight, and there's, you know, they found your email address, and they're saying something, you know, like, I have to do an oral, you know, report on you in the morning. Can you what you had in mind when you wrote this poem, or give me a capsule of your entire writing career in a paragraph?
Oh, gosh.
And it's due at 8:00 in the morning.
Right. How do you respond to that?
You know what, Carrie? I try and be very, very good. And instead of saying something parental like, why would you leave this to the last minute?
Right.
I usually go, okay, here's a few bullet points. I'm not going to tell you what the theme of the poem is, but you might think about this or that.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, no, I try and save their bacon, but
right.
Sometimes it's too late.
Oh, gosh, great. That's a great story with that. But no, I mean, congratulations. I mean, that's, like you said, that's amazing to just, like you said, the amount of attention it can get. It's kind of reminding me of a song, you know, when someone samples a piece of someone's song, and then it's like, they're like, oh, who is that person? And then they look that person up, and now they're buying Bart's books because his work was anthologized in, you know, this textbook. So that's really neat.
No, that's a very good connection, Carrie.
Thanks. All right. So your poetry, I mean, again, that would be another 10 episodes of this podcast. But I mean, I think what I like so much about it is it's so diverse. You know, it's covering topics ranging from politics, which is interesting because, you know, you bring up how you were a political science major with the philosophy. You know, to, I think, themes of existentialism. And then, of course, to themes of lifetime experiences and everything in between, we could say. So, but I, what I like, too, not just about the diversity of it, is just the fact that it's very abstract in nature. I like how it's left open to interpretation for the reader. And that's something I like about music, too. I like when a song is a little more, you know, mysterious, so to speak, so you can apply it to yourself. So with that, let's talk a little bit about, you know, this new book that you have out. It's called This Body Is Never at Rest, with the new and selected poems from 1993 to 2023, 46 new poems in the new book, which is fantastic, as well as selected poems from all of your other books. What I love about the book, I think, most is I really like the title. And I think I like it because, to me personally, and you could tell me I might be totally off and wrong, but I like the meaning of it. I think there's so many different layers to it. I think it could be looked at from the surface of you personally. Your body's never at rest. You're always writing. You're always thinking about new concepts for your literature and poetry. But I also think this was an interesting interpretation, that it's a body of work that's going to live on forever one day. So even, God forbid, you know, with our own mortality, you're not around, your body's always going to live on, this body of work. What are your thoughts? And then tell me a little bit about how you came up with the title.
Sure. And you're absolutely right. There's a lot of layers to all of this. But what you said, yes, you know, there will be time to rest at one point. At one point, we will all be resting. But before then, yes, you want to do what you can in this life. You feel that you have something to add, something to say. And I'm not saying it, you know, to any great, great shakes. But you feel, maybe going back to the way this interview began, you feel that you have a voice. You feel that mm-hmm. there's something you want to say. So it has that level. It's got a personal level as well. Some of this also comes in just in terms of a personal level from my wife, and the fact that she is a woman who is always moving, mm-hmm. never at rest, even when she's sleeping, she is moving. And so I think when I started to write the poem, I think I had her in mind. However, the poem itself goes a lot of different ways. Mm-hmm. And so I think, again, this is what a poet very often is interested in. It's not like poets are trying to, you know, have a blindfold, or they're trying to do something that's so esoteric that can't be figured out. It's just that idea again about layers. Mm-hmm. Complex poetry, it doesn't have to be the type of poetry you have to run to a dictionary or you have to, you know, go to a thesaurus or something. It's just, you can read it just like a good song, as I think you were implying. Mm-hmm. And there are different levels. So you look at it at one point. You know, I think of reading Robert Frost's poems or William Butler Yeats' poems or Theodore Rutke's poems. You read it at a certain point. Some of these poems I've been reading since high school or college. I'm still getting different meanings out of them.
Right.
Because I'm different and my life changes.
Right.
So I'm still quite a well, you know. I keep putting the bucket down into the water, and it's interesting what you draw up from that well, you know, each time. So, like I said, there will be time enough to rest at
right.
at the end of life. For now, yes, you're trying to be part of a universe, I think, that is interested in voices. And just like I said about all the different cultural aspects mm-hmm. of getting these grants and everything, just taking everything in. I mean, you're like a, you know, you're like a vase, and everything that gets added to it every day. I mean, it's a, you know, it's a way to live life where you feel as if the glass is a lot more than, you know, half full.
Right. Right. No, I think that's a, I think that's a very good way to describe it. With the book, you know, when did you come up with, you know, was that the first poem you wrote, which became the title of it? You know, the poem, This Body's Never at Rest, was that the one? Or had you had a whole collection of poems and then that one stood out and you said, this is what I think would capture it? Yeah, tell us a little bit about just kind of where were you when this came to you? Were you sitting in a certain place in your house? Were you out getting coffee? You know, how all this came together. And also, pull in, I love the fact of you, you know, sectioning out morning, afternoon, and evening for the different chapters in the book. Again, I love the symbolism of that. Again, the body's never at rest and this clock of morning, afternoon, evening going constantly.
Right. So in this case, I did have poems before. So it wasn't as if, right, I came up with that and then was writing all the poems for that. Because that's another interesting thing. So if there are 45, 46 poems in that new section for This Body is Never at Rest, that usually means there's probably anywhere between 200 and 300 poems that were written.
Wow.
And then maybe 45 were selected. When I started writing books like Crossing the Hackensack, the first book 30 years ago, you know, maybe it was 2-to-1 or 3-to-1. So if there are 40 poems in that book, let's just say maybe I had written 80, 90 poems, something like that.
Right.
The more you go on, the more specific and selective you become. It's very, very different than the earlier books.
Sure.
So I think what happened with This Body is Never at Rest is I did think that would be a good possible title. And then maybe I pick out 4 or 5 different titles. Then I look at the poems and I see, is any one of these going to work directly?
Mm-hmm.
And it usually takes one of the worst things to do sometimes, you know, is pick out a title and then attempt to do those sections that you were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes there's some writers who don't even want to deal with the order of the poems. They may make the selections, but they may even have an editor who says, you know, I think I see this kind of panorama.
Mm-hmm.
And so let's do it this way. It's one of the most difficult things is ordering the poems. I mean, it's hard enough, yes, let's say to pick 46 out of 250. That's hard.
Oh, gosh.
But
right.
Then doing the sectioning and how they match up. I will tell you that when you do a new and selected collection like This Body, It's Never at Rest, you also have another problem, which is the poems appear in a certain order in each individual book. But then once you take that book of, let's say, 50 poems,
right,
and then reduce it down to 15 or 20 that you're going to do of that book in the new and selected, then you got to look at the poems again.
Right.
Because you don't have 50. You got 15. It's just like somebody doing a CD.
And that's what I was just going to say.
Yeah. Somebody's greatest hits. And all of a sudden, okay, wait a minute. I'm culling this one from the first CD. This one from the fourth CD. How are they gonna jive together?
Mm-hmm.
I don't want 4 love poems or love songs together.
Right.
I don't want 4 depressing songs together. And so you have to go back and, if you will, kind of retool everything.
Right. Wow. How long did it take you to put this together, would you say?
Well, I think that little by little after I, you know, after Metal Art published Whistling to Trick the Wind, I think I had begun to think, okay, what would I do with a new and selected? So I started to go through each individual book and at least, again, you know, pierce and call out the 15 to 20 poems. Then after I said, oh, that looks good, then I was writing even more of the new ones. And to be, you know, to be honest about everything, you always have to be, I think it's just like an actor, you know, who finishes a film. That actor doesn't want to just sit and wait until that film comes out to the public. It could be 5 months. It could be 2 years. So the first thing the actor wants to do is to immediately get another role and immerse himself or herself in another, you know, the picture that they finished is going to come out in a year. But so what I'm doing right now is already I have, even after This Body Is Never at Rest, because probably all those poems were finished, you know, 7-8 months ago. So now we're sending out work, because that's what you do. You send individual poems out to literary journals. So we've sent, I don't know, quite a few out, but we already have maybe 40, 45 poems since This Body Is Never at Rest, you know, was done, that have been accepted by literary journals, by about 35 different journals.
Awesome.
So we're, you know, I don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. I could be no more. But at least this point, we're already, and I'm already thinking of a title for perhaps the next book and how those poems would match up, how they would be integrated into another book.
Wow, congrats. I mean, what an amazing, again, accomplishment with all these books.
Yeah, I don't
book.
Know what's going to happen, but I know
but
that,
still.
I, to quote you, I know I should never be at rest.
Right. let's talk a little bit, because you mentioned Metal Ark, so I definitely want to plug them. You know, tell us a little bit about the story. How did you meet them? Plug a couple of the players. I know I want to mention thank you very much to Lindsay Garcia. She's been an absolute pleasure to work with and, you know, getting some of the information I needed to put the whole interview together. So I want to, again, thank you to her. But yeah, please let us know. How did you hook up with them and give us a little story behind them?
Sure. So remember I was telling you about there was that period between 2012 and 2021. So I was writing, but, you know, somehow, you know, I was thwarted by something in terms of not, you know, sending work out and just, you know, I wasn't feeling very good about the fact that I wasn't writing, but somehow I wasn't propelled to do so. And I don't know if it was 2019, 2020, but there is a friend of mine who I got to know through his work as the Poet Laureate of Kansas, a wonderful gentleman by the name of Kevin Rabus. And we had been corresponding, and he wanted me to enter this contest that Meadowlark had sponsored called the Birdie Prize. And I did enter it. I was a semi-finalist, so I did not win the prize. But he got me speaking to some people at Meadowlark, to the publisher, Tracy Simmons, to the publicist, Lindsay Garcia. And so little by little, we talked about possibly my manuscript and about them doing a book. And that worked out. And I love the fact that they had faith in my work. Mm-hmm. And so that's where it kind of began. And they did Whistling to Trick the Wind. They did a great job on it. I immensely liked the folks that were there. It's a small literary publisher in Emporia, Kansas. We joke about the fact that they are small, but they are mighty.
Yes.
So that's what started all of this. And then little by little, we began discussing the possibility of doing a new and selected book. And Tracy was very much behind it. Lindsay championed it. And I was able to do some work with Susan Sisko on the beginning of the layout. She's the one who did some of my other books and even the Eclipse journals. So we all kind of started working together. And everything came to fruition just, recently. And I had not met Tracy or Lindsay until 2 weeks ago when
you were
into Kansas.
Yeah, Kansas.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
wow.
I had gone to Kansas before, and I think I had possibly met Tracy at a reading that I did at Emporia State. But I did not know anything about Meadowlark that actually didn't, really come into being until 2014. So it's funny, I had been in the town, I had done workshops, readings, some signings at Emporia State in Kansas. So it was just kind of serendipity that I ended up with my publisher being there. And there was a conference in Kansas City a week and a half ago, which is the largest conference of creative writing folks in the world.
Cool.
AWP, Associated Writing Programs. So we started out in Emporia State. I signed a lot of books. We did this and that. And then we all ended up in Kansas City at the conference, which I thought was great for Meadowlark. They had not attended AWP before. Yeah, it was great. We met a lot of the Emporia folks who were so sweet to Kim and to me. And I think we not only, do I have a publisher that I love and respect, but we just met some kind, generous folks in Emporia that I have a feeling we are going to know for a long, long time.
That's great. No, that's awesome. Yeah, and I think I like just hearing you talk about, because me personally, I like things that are smaller, more intimate, more connected. I mean, it sounds like with Meadowlark Press, that's what you're getting. You're not walking into this massive publisher where there's billions of people and it's hard to get anywhere. I like this kind of, like I said, the smallness and the more intimateness of that, where they can really put their attention to you and your work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And especially Lindsay has just done so much work publicizing everything. And yes, she's a gem.
That's great. Yeah, no, she's great. Tell us about, I always love to ask about artwork. So the cover art of your book, I want to know a little bit about why you chose to go, with a black and white picture. Tell us a little bit about Carolyn Ellsworth Henley, who was involved with the photo, and Austin Doyle regarding the cover design. I love it. So yeah, tell us a little bit about the cover of it.
Well, that's very interesting because this dovetails is what I told you about when I went to California and when I was teaching at the four different community colleges, because Carolyn Ellsworth Henley was my girlfriend who was teaching at three.
Wow.
So she was also part of that internship program at Kingsborough Community College.
Gotcha.
So I met her, and what is bizarre is that cover photo was taken at Montauk Point in Long Island, which is interesting because Kim, my wife, and I spend very, you know, we spend quite a lot of time on the North Fork of Long Island, not far from where that picture was taken. So that's pretty crazy because you're talking almost about 40 years after that picture was taken. We spend a lot of time in that, you know, in that area.
That area. Yeah.
The picture is interesting because that picture sat in a drawer of mine for years and years and years. I always liked the photo. I would never think of putting a picture of, you know, of myself on a cover, except possibly for a new and selected, just because it again encompassed all those years.
Sure.
So I had the picture, but it was old. I didn't think it would work. And so we actually had someone also on Long Island who we met with one of our trips, an artist who actually did a painting of me, a watercolor, that we thought we were going to use. But when it came time to really seeing how that would work on the cover, we thought, that is interesting. It's interesting as a painting. I'm not sure how it would work as the cover. So for a few despondent weeks, we weren't sure exactly what we were going to do. And then, of course, I said, God, I've got that picture, but I just thought it was in such poor shape.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a friend, Dennis Doyle, who is a Celtic harper. One of the poems in the book is dedicated to Dennis from Crossing the Hackensack. But he was at my house one day. We were talking, and his son, Austin Doyle, does a lot of work with writers in Hollywood. And because of the writer's strike, he had very little work. And at some point, Dennis said, why don't we get Austin over here, have him look at that black and white photo and see what he thinks. And so, you know, the next morning he was here, he looked at the photo, he said, I really think we can do this. And
that's awesome.
He found some incredible, you know, scanner, was able to do some stuff, touch up, whatever.
Sure.
And, immediately, within 2 days, I saw it and I said, this is going to work.
Right.
And so then I touched with, you know, Tracy, my publisher, sent something over, Austin did, and, and that was it. It's funny, sometimes when you get a cover that, you know, that works, you know, everything just kind of falls into place. So
sure.
I'm glad. That's what I wanted to do kind of from the beginning. You'll see that there's no picture on the back of me. There's no picture usually above the bio.
Right.
I thought one picture of me on the front was more than enough.
Right. Now I'm sorry to hear about the distressful moments, unfortunately, in between all this going on with the watercolor, unfortunately not working out. But it sounds like it came full circle to kind of what you wanted to consider from the beginning.
Absolutely. Right. From the beginning. Yes. Exactly.
Yeah. No, it's great. No, it's great. I think it's very well suited for, like you said, the type of book it is, and the work in it. So no, congrats. Excellent.
Thanks.
So why don't you, let's do this, you know, throw in anything else you want to share with the audience. And then we'll start, I guess, winding things down. You can, of course, plug where the book is to order, Metal Lark Press, where people can find you on your website, social media.
Yeah. So, again, all I would say, first of all, I want to thank you for such an in-depth interview and your acute skills at being, asking poignant questions and questions that that do matter. I think you've done a great job in the time that we've had. All I really want to do is just thank a lot of people out there for their support. Certainly Meadowlark for sure. But I'd also like to thank Red Hand Press, who did four of my books.
Mm-hmm.
Prometheus, who did the first. Lightning, who did the second. But I am very beholden, of course, in the most wonderful way to Meadowlark. And again, like any other poet or artist, you know, I apologize, you know, to so many people about saying, oh, this book is out there. This is great. See if you can. But you know the way this is.
You have
especially
to.
With a small publisher. Exactly.
Yeah.
You absolutely have to. The good part about it is when you do very much respect your press and Meadowlark, so that, yes, you can say, do this to support poetry. Meadowlark also is growing and growing. So they started out as a regional Midwest press, and they're publishing a lot of writers and poets that are on each coast.
Mm-hmm.
So they're doing great stuff. So yes, I would certainly tell people to order the book. I think they'll find especially this book interesting because it does encompass the 30 years, and I think they
yes.
can get a direction from the book, and you know, at least see, analyze, if you will. But I have great respect for Meadowlark, and I'm so glad that book is out there in the world, that people can order it. And again, thank you so much for the interview.
Absolutely, absolutely. And what we'll do is, again, I don't want to say too much at the end because I will do that little edit. Anyone who didn't have a chance to listen, please share the link again later today once I get the edit done. It'll be great because people can then, you know, they can stream it, they can download it at their convenience, whether they're drinking their coffee, driving in their car. So I really want to get this out there so people can hear about, you know, the historical background on you. I think that's such a rich part of encapsulating who you are as this, you know, talented poet.
And I appreciate that.
All right. So, yeah, thank you so much, Bart, for joining me. I look forward to, you know, pushing this out there, getting some more books sold for you, and having people learn a lot more about you as an individual and as a professor and a poetry writer.
Thank you so much, Carrie, and I've appreciated all the time we have spent together.
Thank you so much, too. All right, we'll be in touch.
You bet. Take care. Bye-bye.
Okay, take care. All right. All right, everyone. Bart Edelman, please check out his poetry book that is available through Meadowlark Press titled This Body is Never at Rest, New and Selected Poems from 1993 to 2023. Again, if you tuned in late, the podcast will be available after it's over. Just give it a little bit of time to get it updated where it can be streamed and downloaded. You can find my podcast on iTunes, on iHeartRadio, and also any other major digital sites. Please also follow me at Carrie Edelman on Facebook. I'm also on Instagram. I have a personal page at Carrie Edelman and The Carrie Edelman Show. So I'm always updating it with new and upcoming interviews. Hopefully in the near future, I do have some other people in the works, some cartoonists, comedians, writers, and the list goes on. So thank you so much for the support. Every interview I do an extensive amount of research. It's going to be unique and different for every person. So I hope you'll check them out and support all these amazing artists and entertainers that I've had on. Thank you so much and have a great day.